that their largest criminal firm was ostensibly run by an 80-year-old gangster named Tony Pallas, but in fact had been taken over by his 45-year-old son, Reggie. Court thought he was selling himself well, but he knew he had to remain sharp and not let his guard down for an instant. Jones said,
"Reggie ain't his dad, is he?"
"No, sir. He's a right bastard. With all the coke he does, he's fucking useless most of the time. Can't be bothered about real problems, even if it throws his own men into danger."
Court had read that the man had been arrested for cocaine possession more than once. The rest of it he was winging. He'd spent most of 2 decades freestyling his way through background stories, and he was damn good at it. Jones said,
"I know Reggie Pallas. How about I call him right now, make sure you are who you're saying you are?"
Court shrugged.
"He'll just tell me to get me arse back down to Southampton, won't he? That's not what you want."
"It's not. What is it you and Kent cooked up? What do you want from me?"
"The name of the bloke who reached out to you about this in the first place."
"And what will you do with that?"
"I'll give him a talking to."
The man seemed unsure, but then he stood, headed across the pub alone, and sat in a booth on the far wall. Court was confused, but once there, Jones motioned him over. Grabbing his carling, he complied. He was halfway across the floor before 2 men grabbed him and roughly frisked him, causing much of his beer to spill. Finding no weapons or microphones, they let him proceed, and he sat down across from Jones. Jones leaned forward, speaking softly now.
"I'm asking myself why I pass along important information like that to some geezer I don't even know, never heard of, working for a bastard that I don't respect."
Court said,
"Because all this today happened on your turf. To your men. All the other firms sent 1 man on this op, you sent 1, and then, when Kent came here, you sent him 2 carloads more, didn't you?"
"What of it?"
"Your losses make me suspect you want payback for this shite, same as me. Maybe more."
"You're right. 7 of my men killed today, good men all. And you were the one tosser who walked away with your life. How is that?"
Court said,
"Don't know. But I do know I'm going to find the people responsible for sending us into that bleeding buzzsaw, and I'm going to put this right."
Court could see both indecision and skepticism on the older man's face. Finally, he said,
"You and Kent had yourselves some sort of pact to avenge the deaths of a load of blokes you just bloody met for 1 op.
For me, it's not about the other blokes on this op. I react poorly when people try to send me to the slaughterhouse. Kent and I didn't have a plan. I just told him I wanted the name, and I was sure my boss wouldn't give it to me. He said he would ask you."
Court shrugged.
"Then he died, on your turf, along with 6 more of your crew. I'm betting you wouldn't mind someone not attached to you in any way dealing with the bastard who caused all this."
Charlie Jones sat and drank in silence for a minute. Court sipped his lager, waiting. Finally, the leader of the Nottingham criminal firm said,
"I don't know who sent this whole thing up, but I do know who I talked to. A solicitor in London. He works for some interesting chaps, Russians mostly. Underworld all."
Court nodded.
"A name?"
Another long pause from Jones before,
"Tell you what. A couple of my boys will take you to an inn right down the street. You stay here tonight, and I'll do some looking into you. I find out you are with Southampton, and were there at Turnhill and Rossby today. Then I'll tell you what you want to know."
"I don't have time for that. If I'm going after the men that did this, I have to do it now."
"If you want the information from me, you have to play by my rules, lad. I'll talk to you in the morning about what I learned."
Court said,
"You're not getting my bloody name, Jones. Pallas finds out I'm doing this and I'm in loads of bleeding trouble." "Don't need your name. Got your description, don't I? I know blokes in Southampton who will tell me if a dark and angry shooter who looks like you works for Reggie Pallas. Don't worry, lad. I can be discreet."
He shrugged.
"I hope you check out. I want someone's bollocks for what happened to me, boys."
Court started to protest again, but he realized it was futile. A minute later, there were four firm hands around Court's biceps, and he was being led back outside, then turned and walked towards a small and simple inn at the end of the street. He knew his scheme would fall apart if Jones took even a couple hours to dig into him, and he couldn't let that happen. He had no real doubt he could make short work of these guys, even though he could plainly see the butt of a 1911 pistol inside the jacket of the man on his left. But he had to remain in character, even for just a short time more, to increase any slim chance his plan had for success. The check-in process for the inn involved one of the heavies with Court stepping behind the counter and pulling a set of keys off a shelf, while the front desk clerk looked on silently, and seconds after that, the three men began walking up a staircase. Court was led to a room at the end of a hall. The door was opened by the guy with the .45, while the other grabbed a chair by the tiny elevator door and dragged it over. Court entered his room, gave a nod to the men who led him there, then closed it, just as the one man sat down on the chair, facing the stairs and elevator. Looking around the simple space, he realized the room had no balcony. There were two windows, one on either side of the bed, and while they weren't large, they opened to the side. He peered outside and down the street, then stepped out onto the windowsill in a crouch. He used a drainpipe to climb down to ground level and was clear of his two minders a minute and a half after they locked him in his room. It took him another 30 to steal a locked Vespa scooter from behind a theater in the city center. As he putted off back in the direction of the pub, he wondered if he would end up stealing or commandeering every vehicle in the UK before this damn operation ended. Chapter 20. Charlie Jones left his pub at 9, walked out to his Jaguar, and folded into the back seat. His driver and his bodyguard climbed into the front, and together the three men headed west through town towards a restaurant Jones frequented. It was only a 10-minute drive, and the crime boss spent the time on his phone, calling people who knew people in Southampton. He was determined to find out if one of Reggie Palace's men was missing, and if so, if the man fit the general description of the man he'd met tonight. Jones liked the thought of having a dead man working for him, untied to his syndicate, unaffiliated with his town. If this stranger checked out, Jones had decided he would give him the information about the bastard who'd set this up and see what he did with it. If the man did manage to pull off some sort of retribution for Jones's dead crew, then Jones would want to talk to this fellow again. There was always a need for a proxy asset in organized crime. Charlie Jones and his bodyguard climbed out of the Jaguar at the entrance to the restaurant and stepped inside. As had been the case with the pub, the people at the restaurant knew him well. They kept a table for him, and he in turn watched out for them. He was taken to his table in the back of the room, while his bodyguard took a stool at the bar, his regular perch, and ordered a soda water. The bodyguard faced the door, monitoring anyone who came in to see if they posed a threat to his protectee. Jones's driver stood outside by the Jag, smoking a cigarette and thumbing through text messages on his phone. He didn't hear anyone walk up behind him on the darkened pavement, so he was surprised when a voice coming from not 3 feet away said, "Hey, mate, got a light?" The bodyguard spun his head around to the voice and straight into a vicious right jab to his face, knocking him out cold. Court scooped up the man and dragged him quickly up onto the stoop in front of the carpet store. Once out of view from the restaurant on his right, he knelt over the man, reached into his coat, and fished around for a weapon. As had been the case with the heavy who'd escorted him to the inn, Court saw that the driver had a .45 caliber pistol in a shoulder holster. And while the old 1911 model pistol wasn't Court's first choice for combat, it was certainly a supremely lethal and imposing weapon. He pulled the pistol, jabbed it into his pants under his shirt, then headed around back to enter the restaurant from the kitchen. Charlie Jones put down his mobile phone and fumed. He'd spent the last 10 minutes on a conference call between a friend in London and his contact in the employ of Reggie Palace, head of the Southampton criminal firm. This man claimed to have direct knowledge of the gunman Pallas had sent up to Turnhill, and from what he relayed to Jones about the man, none of the details seemed to match at all. For starters, the actual gunman sent by Southampton was 47 years old. He was tall, well over 6 feet, with black hair streaked with gray. But the man Jones had met tonight, claiming to be the lone asset from Southampton, was of average height, with brown hair, and he appeared to be under 40. Jones sipped his Pinot Noir. His salad was placed in front of him, but he did not touch it.
"Damn it," he said softly.
It was settled now. No, the man locked in the inn back near the pub wasn't who he said he was. He was some sort of infiltrator, here in possession of a great deal of knowledge about what had happened in Turnhill and Rossby, but he was definitely not who he claimed to be. Jones shook his head at the audacity of it all. He reached for his mobile again, ready to call his employees waiting back in the inn near the pub to instruct them to beat the man to death and then throw him in a ditch on a country road. But as he started to lift the phone, a hand appeared over his, gently holding the phone down. The man connected to the hand sat down at the table, and when Jones looked up, he realized it was the stranger. For a man unaccustomed to feeling fear, Jones found the tightening twinge in his chest especially unsettling. The local crime boss turned to his man, who was positioned far across the room. But the bodyguard was facing the entrance, not his boss, and it was evident now that the stranger had slipped in from the kitchen in the back of the dining room. Jones spoke softly but sternly.
"I call out and he pulls his gun. It'll be over for you quick, lad."
The stranger lifted Jones's napkin off the table, took it back to his lap, and wrapped it around the .45 pistol he pulled from under his shirt. He put the napkin and the gun back on the table, its barrel pointing at Jones. In his best impersonation of a Southamptoner, he said,
"Does his gun look anything like this?"
"Probably so, since I nicked this one from your driver out on the street."
Jones turned to the window, then back to the man in front of him.
"Where is my driver now?" "He's resting."
An eyebrow twitched as Charlie Jones realized he was beaten. He recovered and said,
"I talked to some mates in Southampton about you, men with the firm down there. They say the bloke they sent to Turnhill was 47 years old."
The stranger said nothing.
"Come on then, let's have it."
"Have what?"
"A secret to that youthful skin of yours."
It was a joke, but the stranger made no reaction to it. Just then, the bodyguard at the bar scanned back in the direction of his boss. His head began to turn back to the front door, but then it snapped back to the table across the room. He rose to his feet quickly, obviously astonished to see the stranger from the pub now seated with Jones. Court grabbed the napkin-wrapped pistol and held it under the table. Calmly, he said,
"You're gonna want to wave him back to his stool, Charlie."
Jones did so. The man hesitated, then sat back down, but opened his coat and put his hand inside, his eyes locked on the stranger. Court eyed the bodyguard back, matching the man's malevolent stare. Without taking his eyes from this threat, he said,
"I'm just here to talk. I was bleeding right not to trust you."
"No, sir, you were wrong. I'm exactly who I said I was. I'm the bloke who's gonna exact some payback from the people who got all your boys killed."
"But you ain't from Southampton, are you?"
"I'm from one of the other firms. I won't be saying which."
Jones closed his eyes a moment, a look of frustration on his face.
"I knew something was off about that accent of yours."
Court found himself momentarily crestfallen. He thought he should have been awarded an Oscar for his performance, but he made no outward reaction. Jones sipped his wine, but Court could see the man's nerves. Court had been unnerving people for decades, after all, so he knew the cues. The Brit said,
"Why should I help you now?"
"Because I'm the guy you want fighting for you, and I'm also the guy you don't want fighting against you. You give me the name of this man in London, then I get up and walk out the door. You don't see me again. You don't ever learn my name. You just sit right here, live your life, and know that sooner or later, the people involved with all this will pay for what happened to your men. Hell, if you want, you can take credit for it. Tell all your mates you were the one who exacted retribution for your 7 employees. Court shrugged. Or don't. I don't give a toss either way.
Charlie Jones finished his glass, then poured more wine from the bottle. He didn't offer any to Court. While this was going on, the front door to the restaurant opened, and Jones's driver rushed in, his eyes searching across the room to the table where Court and Jones now sat. There was a panic-stricken look on the man's swollen face that did not diminish when Jones waved the man over to the bar to sit next to the bodyguard. After he'd downed several more sips, Jones continued,
"I don't like you, mate, but I do like your style. I'll give you what you're after. The solicitor's name is Terry Cassidy. He contacted me, put me in touch with the bloke who paid me for Kent's involvement, a bloke who didn't give a name, but he was an Ivan for certain."
"He was Russian?"
Court clarified.
"Aye. I should have known from the start. I know fuck all about the plan, the reasons behind it, who the prisoner was. Never met the Ivan face to face. All done over the phone."
"Terry Cassidy knew to come to you for a shooter?"
"Shooters and muscle. He's a middleman. You know the score, lad. You lot, head knockers, I mean, aren't bringing in the money unless you're bashing in faces or pulling out pistols. I farm out me boys for the going rate. Last night was a bigger scheme. I knew that much, so I got triple for poor Kent."
Court asked,
"If this guy was Russian mob in London, why did he hire muscle from a crime firm in Nottingham?"
Jones waved a dismissive hand in the air.
"They do it all the time. The Russian mafia likes to hire proper Englishmen to do some of its dirty work. Keeps them off the radar of the Yard and the Met."
Court nodded, reached across the table, and shook Jones's hand. It occurred to him that if Jones had any inkling that the man sitting with him had killed all 7 of his people this morning, Court wouldn't be leaving this bar alive.
"Thank you, sir. What you gonna do now?"
He downed the last of the wine in Jones's glass.
"I'm getting up and going out through the kitchen, and I'm hoping your lads don't shoot me in the back. I'll see they behave. Then what?"
"Then I'm going to London."
"Yeah? Well, if I learn you talked, I'll start calling around. I'll find out who you're with, where you are. I'll come at you with everything I got. Do we have an understanding?"
"A perfect understanding, Mr. Jones. Thank you very much indeed."
Court stood and headed for the kitchen. Every step of the way, he felt more certain someone was about to stop him, to grab him, to pull a weapon on him. But he made it to and through the door, and 5 minutes later he was running an SDR through the streets of Nottingham, making sure he was clean before he grabbed a train to the capital. The Cessna Sovereign jet lifted into a cloudy Virginia sky at 4:30 p.m. with a flight plan filed for Greenland and a stop in Newfoundland along the way. Zoya Zakharova sat in the co-pilot's seat, doing her best to acquaint herself with the gauges, dials, and computer screens. With only 110 hours in single-engine fixed wings and not a single minute flying multis, she was by no means an experienced pilot. But she knew that with a little familiarization with the cockpit, she'd be able to monitor systems when Arkady Kravchenko took breaks throughout the crossing. By leaving America, she'd slipped the noose of CIA and FBI, who would be searching the DC area for her, and she'd managed to avoid the hit team that showed up at her safe house just as she was in the process of escaping. But neither of these facts was involved with the initial reason for today's clandestine exodus. No. Something had occurred to her while lying in bed back in her holding room, obsessing over the photos of her father in Dagestan. Something that caused her to break out of American custody, to impersonate an active SVR officer to reboot a defunct asset to help her get out of the country. Something that forced her to travel to London. Now. She'd been so mission-focused since the moment she'd sat up in her bed in her holding room. The realization of what she'd seen in the file Brewer handed her only then occurring to her, that she had barely stopped to think about the deeper meaning of what she'd learned. But facing over 15 hours in the air, her thoughts returned to the photos. And now, just like in the holding room, an icy chill shot down her back. Zoya Zakharova was 33 years old, but she fought against emotions that brought her back to her childhood. She tried to shake them off, but the ramifications of all this for her were just too big. She didn't know how everything, how anything, would play out in the coming days and weeks on this quest she had begun late last night. The odds were long, to be sure. But she had to push forward because she knew one thing now that she did not know before she saw the file on her father. She now knew, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that her father did not die 14 years ago in Dagestan. He was alive in the photo. It had been staged. She assumed he was alive now, and she knew where to go to find out answers about where he was and what he was doing. Her emotions threatened her mission. This she warned herself of as she watched the nose of the Cessna break out of the clouds and into sunshine over the Chesapeake Bay. She'd have to fight to keep those emotions in check. But as she evaluated herself right now, taking notice of how she felt, she realized her main reaction to what she had learned, that her father was alive, was telling. She felt no elation. She felt no excitement. She felt no hopefulness. No, she'd just learned her father was alive, and right now, she found herself fighting against an overpowering sense of dread. Chapter 21. 4 months earlier, Janice Wan moved to the United Kingdom, using the same name she used in Stockholm, and through David Mars and Terry Cassidy, she started a company, on paper at least. Her firm, Biospherical Research Labs, specialized in laboratory research of infectious diseases, ostensibly under contract with the National Health Service. Mars purchased a real firm under Wan's offshore corporation name, then sold it for parts, although the firm retained all its licenses and contracts so it could purchase items without raising eyebrows. Wan spent the first couple of weeks in an office in Soho, London, not a laboratory, and here she drafted a list of items she needed and a list of requirements for a lab to grow and weaponize the Yersinia pestis bacteria she'd successfully taken from the lab in Sweden. She also read through resumes of lab assistants Mars had selected as suitable, trying to find one or two people to help her, although they would think they were working for the front company, and they would never see the weaponized version of the spores. Wan was busy, but she was frustrated at the pace of one element of her preparation. To date, she had not been given the information she requested from her new employer. She didn't yet know the size and scope of the attack David Mars had in mind, or the distribution of the intended victims. She didn't know if she would be attacking a football stadium, a sprawling metropolis, or a single building with her spores. She found it ridiculous that she was having to base her needs on wild guesses about her objective, but Mars took her requests and went to work finding her a laboratory without giving her any more information. It only took him a few days before he met with her in Soho. "Your lab will be in a private building next to Edinburgh University in Scotland. There is an existing facility there, no longer in use. It was built for medical research, but with some work it can be turned into a suitable lab for you. I have contacts in the local police. You will be well protected there, just as long as you use good operational security and don't ever let out what is going on."
"I have been trained, Mr. Mars."
"I know you have, Doctor. I'm sorry."
"Why Scotland?"
Mars shrugged. "Why not? Quite lovely people up there. You'll like it."
2 weeks later, Wan was in her new facility, watching refrigeration technicians restoring the long-dormant coolers in the old laboratory to operational condition. The rest of the equipment she'd ordered had already been installed, the fermentation vats, the freezers, and the spinners. While the lab was smaller and simpler than where she'd worked in Sweden or in Russia or even in Iran, it was a lot more advanced than where she'd done most of her work in North Korea. Her two assistants had begun working with her, One was a 26-year-old British woman of Pakistani descent, a registered nurse who had worked extensively with infectious disease. And the other was a 24-year-old female Portuguese laboratory tech in the UK looking for more lucrative work. Juan's company, run by David Mars, paid them well, and Juan worked them both hard. As the refrigeration men left, David Mars and Roger Fox appeared in her lab, again showing her how personally invested they were in the attack that she would help prepare. Mars and Juan stepped into her office off the lab floor, while Fox looked around and Hines shadowed him. Mars said, "I trust the laboratory meets your needs."
"Very much so. The two assistants are adequate as well. My only question remains..."
"The target?"
"Yes. I know you won't tell me specifically, but to determine the ideal recipe for the agent, to choose and construct the proper delivery vehicle, I must know something about where this is to happen. Is it a city block? A sports stadium? What's the weather in this location? There are so many variables that must be accounted for before I can even begin work on this."
Mars nodded, drummed his fingers on the table a moment, and then said,
"The location is here, in the United Kingdom, which means you will have to prepare for any weather conditions, say for extreme cold and extreme heat. The target is a building, large, sturdy, well fortified and protected."
"A building like a grocery store, or a building like a shopping center?"
Mars said, "A building like a shopping center."
Juan waited for something more, then said,
"I assume there will be a narrow time window when this must take place."
"You are correct in your assumption."
"How much time do I have before the attack?"
10 weeks.
Janice Juan gasped.
"That is not much."
"You told me the spores will grow quickly."
It can be done, but why didn't you approach me sooner?"
"Because..."
He hesitated, and Juan noticed an unease in the normally composed man in front of her.
"Because I only became sufficiently motivated to enact this attack a few months ago. Believe me, I reached out for a virologist as soon as the idea came to me."
Juan recognized there was a clue here about this mysterious Englishman's motivation, but she could not discern it.
"I see. I hope you understand I will need more information as time draws even closer. Very soon, even."
"I do understand," Mars said. "I will feed you intelligence about the target, the defenses, everything, well in advance of the mission."
Juan wasn't satisfied, but she went back to her work. She had much to do today to set up the perfect conditions here at the lab before she could take the small amount of spores she'd stolen from Sweden and cultivate and weaponize them, and she had no time to waste. Present day. A sleek corporate helicopter descended through the darkness towards a landing pad at a country estate, an hour's drive west of London. The Augusta Westland AW-109 had been purchased the year before for $6 million US by an offshore business owned by David Mars, but untraceable to him. It was a chic craft with a plush interior, a range of 600 miles, and a top speed of 177 miles per hour. Mars sat behind the pilot while a trio of Israeli security officers, all armed with subguns and pistols, sat to his right and behind him. He looked out the window on his left at the estate as they descended. Its impressive landscape lighting throughout the grounds shone brightly in the overcast night on a backdrop of rolling hills dotted with other multi-acre mansions. Upon landing, Mars and his three body men climbed out and turned away from the 13,000-square-foot home and instead walked towards an immaculate horse barn. A half-dozen beautiful Arabians ran around the lighted paddock outside, but Mars did not look at them. The barn was statelier than many mansions, but Mars did not register this. He marched on towards the open barn door, his security details surrounding him. Inside it was utterly spotless, but again, David Mars just walked along, single-minded of purpose.
His men stopped halfway down the hall, but Mars proceeded to the far end of the barn and stepped up to two men standing outside a closed stall door. Mr. Fox wore a blue polo and khakis. He held a mobile phone in his hand. Next to him, Fox's bodyguard, the colossal Englishman John Hines, wore a white undershirt, drenched in sweat, and boxing gloves on his hands. Mars opened with,
"This is talking?"
Fox shook his head.
"Only to swear he doesn't know anything."
Mars looked to Hines now, and Fox understood.
"John did as much damage as he could possibly do without killing the poor bastard. At this point, I have to wonder if this is telling the truth."
The older man shook his head.
"No, nothing else makes sense other than that the leak came from him."
Fox replied with,
"Yes, sir."
They entered the stall and Mars found Dirk Visser sitting in a chair, his arms bound at the elbows and wrists behind him. He was ashen-faced, except where the deep bruising around his eyes and nose colored his skin with blues and grays. Mars saw the man staring, not at him, but at Hines. He was utterly terrified.
"Good evening," Mars said.
When the man did not react, he shouted,
"Do you know who I am?"
Visser's head turned, half-hung, but his eyes scanned Mars' face.
"No. No, sir, I don't."
Mars nodded.
"Where did you come across the name Zakharov?"
Visser closed his eyes and tears pinched out the sides.
"I told your colleague, sir, I don't know a Zakharov. I have many Russian clients, yes. It is possible I just don't recognize the name because he works for one of the smaller entities I manage."
"No, he doesn't work for anyone. He's dead."
Mars pulled up a folding chair waiting for him and sat down in front of the detainee.
"Here's the problem, old boy. Fyodor Zakharov was the top man in Russian military intelligence, a 25-year career going back to the Soviet Union. He dropped off the map, killed in battle, and CIA put his file on a shelf and forgot about him. That is, until just one single day after they picked you up. Now the Yanks are looking into him quite closely, and I, Mr. Visser, am not a man who believes in coincidence."
Who is he?"
"His name is related to some transfers into an account you manage.
Transfers that were converted into Bitcoin by you."
The Dutchman squinted through his swollen eyes. Sweat dripped from his lashes.
If he died, sir, then how is he related to the transfers?"
David Mars sat up straighter in the chair.
"His name is tied to a shell corporation involved in the transaction you managed." "I don't understand. How would I know who is tied to a shell?" "John, please remind our friend again about who is asking the—"
"No!"
Visser shouted.
"I get it. No questions. Don't hit me."
John Hines held back. Mars next asked, "How did you know about Zakharov?"
"I never heard the name before."
Mars stood up from the man, took a half step back, and looked at John Hines again. The former boxer snapped out a jab in a blur and connected with the seated man's right eye, swelling it instantly. Mars said,
"You are being difficult, which means this is going to take a while. I am annoyed to have to stand here in a barn and ask you the same thing over and over, but I'm certainly not as put out as you're going to be about your obstinance."
For the next hour, Visser was asked over and over about Zakharov, with Hines punching him, breaking ribs, and turning his head into a bloody pulp. He revealed nothing. Finally, Mars left the stall and walked outside the barn. Fox and Hines followed along, with Hines only now taking off his boxing gloves. Mars looked to Fox.
"He's good, but the question remains unanswered."
Fox said,
"We must at least entertain the possibility that whoever the woman at the safe house was, she knew your name from some other way. She tipped off the agency and she isn't affiliated with Visser."
Mars said,
"I've been here a long time and to date there has not been one compromise to my operation. Days from the culmination of my life's work and this security leak happens. We've been careful. Exact. I must know why CIA is looking into a long-dead GRU general now.
Mars looked up at Fox. Perhaps I have a traitor in my midst.
Fox sniffed at the older man's comment.
Do you think I'm working for the Central Intelligence Agency?
What? I was turned by the allures of the West?
He looked down at his $5,000 suit and brushed the sleeve with his arm.
I have all the allures of the West I can handle right now, Mr. Mars.
Mars smiled a little at this.
No, Fox wasn't a traitor.
Fox said,
There is someone else here in the UK who knows the truth about Zakharov.
Mars's eyes narrowed a moment, then he shook his head.
No. If there is one man I trust, it's him.
Mars looked to Fox.
You'll come back with me to London. I'll sleep on this tonight and decide what to do in the morning.
John Hines had been standing silently next to them. As Fox and Mars turned for the helo, he spoke the first words in some time.
And this is, sir?
Mars looked back over his shoulder, directly at Hines.
Dump his body in the Thames.
Understood, sir.
Hines turned back towards the barn, not bothering to put his gloves back on. He could snap the little banker's neck with ease, and that way he wouldn't hold up the return flight to London. Chapter 22. The aircraft carrying former Russian SVR operative Zoya Zakharova flew over England above a sea of gray clouds. The pilot, Arkady Kravchenko, had been silent for over an hour, but now he spoke up.
45 minutes from landing. Pay me now.
Zoya was in the right seat, right where she'd been most of the 16 hours of their flight time, and she replied,
I'll pay you in 45 minutes.
Kravchenko growled softly.
No, we'll fly around up here until I get the money.
Not a good idea.
I assume you don't have it in cash. You can wire it from my laptop to my account in the Caymans.
Zoya just looked out through the windshield for several seconds. Finally, she spoke with nonchalance.
There is no money.
She glanced over to the pilot after a few more seconds. The Russian had reddened. His muscles were tensed. But Zoya could tell he'd known the entire time this might happen.
You aren't with SVR, are you?
She shrugged.
I was. At present, I am a free agent. I needed a lift. Don't feel bad. You did a fine job. Next time I talk to Yasenevo, I'll put in a good word for you.
He reddened even more.
I will turn you into the British when we land. Tell them you hijacked me.
I'll be gone before we get to the ramp, and you'll have no proof. And we both know you don't want to draw attention to yourself after this.
The man thought a moment.
I'll contact Yasenevo directly. They'll know you're here in the UK. They'll track you down.
Zoya answered in a tone that conveyed boredom with the topic.
You do that.
For the next 10 minutes, it was silent in the cabin. Then Kravchenko said,
I'm going to the bathroom once more before landing. You have the controls.
And then,
but don't touch a damn thing. Leave the autopilot on and just sit there.
She reached over and handed him a Bluetooth earpiece.
If I have any problems, I'll call you.
He put it in, and she slipped one into her ear, pushing back her headset a bit to accommodate it, while also allowing the microphone to pick up her voice. Kravchenko slid back his seat, climbed out, and headed towards the cabin. He walked to the rear, opened the lavatory door, and stepped inside. Immediately, he looked back up to the cockpit. He saw the brunette woman in the co-pilot seat, her attention focused on the gray outside the windshield.
I'll just be a minute, he said,
and her reply came over the Bluetooth.
No need to rush.
Still looking her way, Kravchenko spun out of the lavatory and moved across the cabin to the galley at the rear. He stepped in, again shielding himself from the woman at the controls. Quickly, he reached for an access panel on the wall there, and upon opening it, he put his hand below the manual cargo door override lever and felt around for a moment. Quickly, his hand found what it was looking for, and he pulled out a small, stainless steel .38-caliber revolver. After he checked the cylinder to ensure that it was loaded, he spoke aloud into his Bluetooth.
I will give you some advice, young lady. Don't cheat a Ukrainian, then threaten a Ukrainian, and then just let him get up and go retrieve a weapon. I'm sure you'll agree it was very stupid of you to allow me the opportunity to get my gun.
Her voice answered, but it was not over his earpiece. Instead, she was right behind him.
Not if I needed to find out where you were hiding it.
Kravchenko spun around quickly and was surprised to find the woman there. She grabbed him by the throat and slammed his head up against the wall of the galley while ripping the pistol from his hand. After a couple more rough shoves against the wall, he crumpled to the deck. Zoya picked the pistol up off the floor. Minutes later, Kravchenko's hands were tied behind his back and he sat in one of the cabin chairs. The plane flew on autopilot with no one at the controls. The Ukrainian man looked up at the woman standing over him with the pistol in her hand.
How are you planning on landing this plane, bitch?
With your help, of course.
He laughed angrily.
I wouldn't be laughing. You're on board too, remember?
You aren't rated for twin engine, and you don't know anything about this aircraft.
She moved him into the cockpit and put him back in the left seat, with his hands still tied behind his back. She pulled out the earbuds and put his headphones over his ears, climbed into the co-pilot's position, and put on her own set. After a deep breath, she took the controls. It was quiet in the cockpit for a long moment, other than the hum of the aircraft's engine. Outside the windshield, she saw nothing but impenetrable gray. Finally, she said,
"Start talking, man."
Kravchenko remained silent. Zoya looked to him, saw the resolution on his face, and realized she had to snap him out of it. She reached over, flipped off the autopilot, and immediately pushed the yoke forward, and the Cessna jet began to dive.
"What the hell are you?"
Zoya said.
"You're right. No way I can land this without you, so let's just go ahead and end it."
"You're fucking crazy!"
Kravchenko shouted.
"Level off! Reduce throttle! Put the fucking autopilot back on!"
Zoya maintained the dive for a few seconds more, wanting to put enough fear in Kravchenko to where he wouldn't defy her again. Then she pulled back on the yoke, throttled back to slow her speed, and re-engaged the autopilot. All the while, the man in the left seat shouted at her.
"What's wrong with you? You're a crazy bitch!"
Zoya replied,
"Yes, I am. Better not to do anything to make this bitch even crazier right now, Arkady."
20 minutes later, she was lined up on the runway lights at London Luton, north of the capital. It was 3:30 p.m., and heavy rain fell. Zoya hoped this meant she'd have an easier time slipping away from immigration and customs when the plane arrived. She checked her altitude and speed and glanced over to Kravchenko.
"How am I doing so far?"
He did not answer. She smiled, an attempt to hide her nerves and indecision.
"I'm disengaging autopilot."
She waited for him to say something, and when he did not, she shrugged and turned it off. She controlled the aircraft with the yoke now, her eyes constantly scanning gauges. When Kravchenko did not speak for a full minute, Zoya began to worry that the man was going mute again, but finally he said,
"Too fast, too high."
Zoya reduced throttle and increased her descent.
"Teamwork, Arkady. I love it. I'm feeling a little less crazy already."
The 60-year-old Russian gave her no more trouble. He talked her down to a safe landing, then complained about her too slow application of reverse thrust and her too fast application of the brakes. Soon they began taxiing toward the fixed base operator where the immigration and customs ramp was located. Zoya told Kravchenko to use his foot pedals to taxi the plane. Then she climbed out of her seat and cut his hands free with her knife. She knelt down behind him, holding the pistol muzzle down, with a hand resting on her thigh.
"Now, two things you will not do. You will not notify local authorities about me. If you do, it will become evident to them very quickly that you are an agent for Russian intelligence."
From the look on his face, she could tell he would comply with this. He didn't need the aggravation.
"And two," she continued, "you will not notify anyone at Yasenevo. Right now, you are nodding your head in agreement, while inside you are planning on ratting me out. But again, You won't. You have no idea what's going on here. It's big. Bigger than you can imagine. This means the second you tell SVR you transported me from the U.S. to Europe, you will become one big, fat, loose end to a complicated situation that they will want to sweep under the rug.
She patted him on the head with the muzzle of the pistol.
Nobody wants to get swept under the rug, do they?
Zoya Zakharova stood, slipped the pistol into her backpack, and opened the door to the aircraft. She leapt to the taxiway and sprinted off into the rain. Kravchenko climbed out of his seat and shut it, lest the customs and immigration people here at Luton find it odd that the aircraft had flown from America with an open hatch. Cursing all the way, he continued taxiing to the ramp. Suzanne Brewer found herself where she didn't want to be, back in front of Matt Hanley's desk, watching him read something, waiting for him to address her. She didn't know what he wanted specifically, but was certain it was information on one or all of the crises she was dealing with at the moment. When Hanley put his reading material down, he looked up at her.
How you doing?
Working all three situations with Poison Apple, as I'm sure you're aware.
Busy time, Hanley said, and this caused Brewer to cock her head.
Indeed, sir. When he said nothing, she added, Is there something I can do for you?
You're gonna hate it.
Brewer groaned inwardly. I already do.
Hanley said,
I need you to go to the Five Eyes in Scotland.
The programs and plans officer didn't even try to hide her eye roll.
Seriously? It's a couple of days away, Matt. And my workload at present is off the charts. I'm completely snowed under with...
You can work Poison Apple from over there. We'll be at the embassy in London, and then we'll have access to the skiff at the venue in Scotland. I just need you there making an appearance.
Can I ask why?
It's getting around the office that I have you working on something sub rosa, and that's not terribly sub rosa, is it? If I keep you cooped up in your office all the time, without having you out and around the others in your pay grade, then it's just going to bring more scrutiny down on you and me and the initiatives we're working on.
Brewer said,
But I have a war room down on 3 working the anthem hunt here in the States. I can't just shut it down and go to Scotland.
You can and you will. You won't find Anthem if she doesn't want to be found. She's probably halfway back to Moscow by now, or who knows... Maybe she's on her way back to Southern California, where she went to college, so she can meet up with a long-lost boyfriend.
That seems incredibly unlikely, considering what we know about...
The point, Suzanne, is that the minute Zakharov slipped the noose around Great Falls, she was in the wind. And she is one hell of an asset who can stay off-grid as long as she wants.
He smiled a little. Remind you of someone else we both know?
An equally insubordinate singleton who also contributes to my ulcer? Yes, someone comes to mind.
Look, Hanley said, leaning closer over his big desk in a way that was intimidating, though Brewer didn't think he meant it menacingly. Our best assessment is that Zoya ran from the safe house because people came to kill her, and we couldn't protect her. We failed her, not the other way around. She doesn't trust us now, but I'm hoping at some point she'll reach out to us, and we can get her back in the fold.
You are very optimistic, Matt.
Or just desperate. I'm not sure which.
It was silent for several seconds. Then Hanley said,
I'm going over in one of the jets. You'll fly with me, the director, Renfro, a couple of assistants, and the director's security detail. I'm also bringing Jenner and his crew over as my security.
Brewer knew that Walter Jenner ran the Special Activities Division's best paramilitary operations team. She said,
There are 6 guys in Jenner's team, and you're the DDO. Do you really think that's enough?
Hanley smiled a little.
It's enough to protect me, anyway. So stay close, and you'll be fine.
Brewer was furious that Hanley was now adding more to her plate. She excused herself to go back to work, because it was going to be an even rougher day than she'd envisioned.
Chapter 23 Court climbed out of the tube station at West Kensington and found himself in the middle of one of London's many ethnically diverse neighborhoods,
It was also an area with a lot of hotels, which meant tourists, and good access to two tube stations, Barons Court and West Kensington. He saw a sign for a basement flat and walked the street to check it out from a tactical standpoint. Then, with a burner phone he'd bought in Nottingham, he called the number on the sign. Within an hour, he was in a leasing office a mile away, signing papers, proffering a CIA passport Brewer had insisted was firewalled from any alias database at Langley and set up only for him. Court had no way of knowing if this was true, but he deemed it worth the risk because he needed a home base in London while he set up surveillance on Cassidy. He rented the place for a full month, but was hoping to start eyeballing the solicitor's office within a few hours and to get what he needed here in London within a couple of days. A daylight infiltration of a building for the purposes of establishing a surveillance hide was, to put it mildly, suboptimal, but he liked his chances. It was nothing he hadn't done 100 times in much less permissive environments than London, England. By 10 a.m., he stood alone in the little furnished flat. It was nicer than most places he stayed, but security-wise, it was good enough. Down a narrow set of metal stairs, an iron gate led to a short passageway between the laundry room and the door to the flat, and the wooden door itself was well-made and secure. He judged the conditions suitable, if not ideal. Soon he was out the door, heading on foot to the nearby neighborhood of Earl's Court. He'd make his way up onto the roof of the building near Cassidy's office and see what he could see. If he couldn't get much good intel, he'd have to go ahead and perform a sneak and peek, but only through surveillance would he know the camera angles and force structure, if any, inside the building. This took time to do right, and Court was anxious to get started almost immediately. He figured if the man was in fact somehow affiliated with elements in the underworld, then there was at least a fair chance he kept a pretty secure work environment. He had a plan for this afternoon and tonight, but he was not ready to act just yet. No, right now, he needed some gear. Zoya Zakharova rented a tiny flat in London's West End, with a small supply of cash and a large supply of bullshit. Her story was that she'd lost her passport. She was a Croatian national who'd been told she'd have to wait up to 3 days for her embassy to get her the paperwork she needed to go back home, and she couldn't afford any place else around. The Pakistani couple who owned the small and poorly kept Soho building took pity on her, and they handed her the keys to a tiny attic room. It was a fourth-floor walk-up, dingy and dark, with two bare light bulbs illuminating the entire studio. There was no furniture, not even a chair or a table. She put her bag down in the middle of the room, sighed, and turned back for the door. She purchased a sleeping bag at an army surplus store in the Arch Gallery, along with eating utensils for one, an olive-green cold-weather balaclava head and face covering, and a few other personal items. She stopped at a hardware store to pick up some tools, a home goods store for a towel and a washcloth, and a thick rubber welcome mat, a sporting goods store for a yoga mat in a canvas case, and a food market for provisions on her way back to the flat. Back inside, she stacked her food on a moldy shelf in the kitchenette, a few bags of crackers, protein bars, canned tuna, and bottled water. In the tiny and foul-smelling bathroom, she put her toothbrush and toothpaste on the rusty vanity and tossed the bath towel and the washcloth over a hanger. She unfurled the sleeping bag in a small closet next to the bathroom door, changed into track pants and a sweatshirt, then sat down cross-legged in the closet with a protein bar in one hand and her phone in the other. She scanned the internet on her mobile phone as she alternately chewed and sipped water, looking at maps and satellite images, solidifying her plan of attack for the evening. At 4 p.m., she climbed into her bag, pulled her .38 pistol close to her, and closed her eyes. She was exhausted with the travel of the past 2 days, but still it was hard to sleep, because her mind continued to race with thoughts of her father. After a call to Brewer and a 2-hour wait, Court climbed out of the tube at Clapham High Street Station and walked to a raised parking garage a block away. It was misting in advance of some real rain predicted later in the day, but Court just wore a gray t-shirt and jeans, and he walked with his backpack over one shoulder. He made his way to the corner of the top level of the garage and found just a few cars parked there. The one man in sight stood next to a silver Volvo S60. Court walked up to him in a relaxed fashion, but with his arms out a little from his sides. The man was young, perhaps 25, with red hair and a short beard. He was dressed in a black raincoat and dress slacks. He had a nervous look to him that caused Court to glance around the area to make sure there were no other dangers lurking about. Sometimes, Court knew, people showed excessive nerves when they knew something was about to go down. Other times, however, especially with newer members to the intelligence game, some folks just couldn't hide the trepidation of the moment and do their job in a cool and calm manner. Court knew this kid was CIA, which meant they were ostensibly on the same side, but Court had had his own issues with CIA for a long time, and he would never let himself trust them again. Though he approached non-threateningly, he had a plan to draw his weapon and put 3 rounds in this asshole's face and neck if he saw any clear sign of threat. Court passed the redhead by and walked to the wall of the rooftop parking space, then turned around with his back to the wall so he could see everything in front of him. This done, he said,
"You're backwards."
The young man cocked his head.
"What's that?"
"You parked your car with the nose against the wall. You can't get out of here without putting it in reverse. Slower. Limited visibility."
When the man said nothing, Court added,
"Basic tradecraft, Ace."
The young man looked at his car, and his face fell a bit with the realization that this obviously seasoned asset was correct. He now looked both nervous and annoyed. Looking back to Court, he said,
"Yeah, well, you violated protocol yourself. You're supposed to be wearing a green shirt."
"It's at the cleaners."
The young man didn't appreciate the humor. He reached for his car door.
"Well then, I guess it's time to back my ass out of here."
Court smiled and said,
"Romeo Papa November 74 Tango Alpha."
The man stopped reaching for the door and stood back up.
"Alpha Quebec Uniform 83 Yankee."
Court raised an eyebrow. The man just stared back at him.
Court said, "Almost there, 007. You missed one."
The young man's eyes hazed over as he thought. Softly, he said,
"Alpha, Quebec, Uniform, 83, Yankee..."
"Shit!"
"Calm down, kid. It's fine. Call your control and they can..."
"No!"
the man said quickly.
"He'll ship me off to New Guinea for fucking up something so simple."
Court said, "Close enough for government work. Let's just let it go. You know I passed the ID check. If you have the items in your car, I'll take them off your hands and nobody ever has to know you forgot Juliet."
The young CIA case officer snapped his fingers angrily.
"Fucking Juliet! Damn!"
Court had moved on.
"The equipment. You've got it?"
The redhead popped the trunk of the little Volvo and Court looked in. Lying there, in an open case, was a short-barreled HK rifle with a variable power night force scope, a suppressor, a laser designator, and a flashlight. The weapon was already loaded with a polymer magazine, which Court dropped with the mag release button to check the ammo. 2 more loaded magazines lay next to it. The young man said,
"A 300 blackout, as requested."
"Subsonic, as requested. Well done, then."
The young man pulled out a backpack that had been lying next to the rifle case. "Electronic surveillance kit, high-end binos, night vis shit, more ammo for your rifle, a Glock 19 with night sights and a high lumen light, extra mags, a Glock 43 in an ankle holster, and a Benchmade Infidel stiletto. Some climbing and rappelling equipment as well." The kid still seemed nervous, but he stretched out a little smile.
"Whatever you're up to, it's going to be badass. You need a wingman?"
Court zipped both bags tight and left them in the trunk.
"Better you spend your time working on memorizing your ID checks."
Court stepped up to him, then stopped and slapped the young man on the shoulder.
"Just messing with you. Anybody who tells you they've never fucked up on an ID string is lying through their teeth. Forget about it."
Then he put a hand out.
"Keys?"
The CIA officer handed over the keys and Court took them.
"Always back in, front grill towards the exit. That'll save your life someday."
He climbed behind the wheel of the Volvo and drove off, backing half the length of the roof before executing a J-turn and disappearing down the ramp. The young American stood there in the parking lot and watched him go, and only then did he realize nobody had said anything to him about the asset taking the car.
damn it, he said aloud.
Chapter 24 Zoya slept fitfully, freakishly in tune with any noise in her building or even the street below, but at 10 p.m., she climbed right out of her sleeping bag, propelled on by her intensity. She rolled the bag tight and tied it, left it in the closet, then did 20 minutes of intense yoga in her underwear so as not to foul her clothes with her sweat. After a shower, she ate a quick meal of tuna fish, drank some more water, and then dressed as if she were a jogger. Once in her track pants and form-fitting pullover, she took several tools purchased that day at the hardware store and taped them to her back and ribs with liberal amounts of duct tape. That way they wouldn't rattle when she moved in a stealthy fashion, and she wouldn't have to worry about a backpack. The .38 she tightened into her drawstring pants. She felt confident the leather holster would keep it in place, even if she had to climb or run. Over this, she slipped on her black Nike raincoat, and then she grabbed the yoga mat carrier. She rolled the thick rubber welcome mat she'd purchased earlier in the day, forced it inside, and slipped the case over her shoulder. A few minutes later, she walked towards the underground station and, although there were no real crowds at 11 p.m. on a weeknight, even here in central London, she managed to slip the billfold out of the back pocket of a man climbing up the stairs next to her as she descended. She then walked confidently to the turnstiles. Reaching into the wallet, she pulled out the man's Oyster card, and she held it over the reader and was allowed in. On the train, she stole a look into the wallet. She pulled out £70 and crammed them into her pocket, thumbed through the man's credit cards but left them where they were, then flipped through a small group of wallet-sized photos. In the first picture, the man she'd just robbed sat with his wife, their little daughter, in his lap. They were all smiling, even the 2-year-old girl. Zoya looked at the father, at the daughter, and she shut her eyes tight, barely holding in her emotions. She closed the wallet and slipped it into her pocket before she opened her eyes again and wiped them with the cuff of her jacket.
"Calm down, Zoya," she told herself. "This is just a job. Just a job."
Shortly before midnight, she climbed out of the underground at Victoria Station and zipped her waterproof jacket tighter as she reached ground level because a steady, tepid rain had begun to fall. She started jogging a route she'd memorized by looking at maps, both at the library in D.C. and then on her phone the evening before. She entered Belgravia, one of the nicest and most expensive parts of London, though from the street this was difficult to tell. The back entrance to Buckingham Palace was just a few blocks ahead of her as she turned off Belgrave and onto Chester Street, but she wasn't infiltrating the Queen's residence. Instead, she quickly made her first right onto Wilton Mews. It looked like a nondescript row of buildings on both sides of a street, barely wider than an alleyway, but Zoya had done her homework, and she knew that every home and every flat in every building on this tiny street cost in the tens of millions of pounds and were packed with all manner of high-end technology. She passed by an archway and made a sharp left into an alley off Wilton Mews. From here, she ran through the darkness until she came to a brick wall on her left. From Google Maps, she saw that on the opposite side of this wall was a back garden for the mansion at 1 Milton Mews. She leapt into the air and grabbed hold of some vent pipes affixed to the brick wall. Scaling her way up to the top, she encountered a row of 3-inch-high, razor-sharp spikes. Zoya unslung the yoga mat carrier off her back, put it between her knees as she held on to the pipe with one hand, and reached inside. From out of the tube, she pulled the welcome mat. Zoya carefully draped the mat over the top of the brick wall, covering the spikes. She climbed the wall, used great effort to distribute what weight she did have to load there as evenly and lightly as possible, and, on the far side, she dropped down into the backyard, crouching between perfectly manicured topiaries. Zoya pulled the knit balaclava down over her face. It was a narrow garden, only 10 meters to the opposite brick wall, but long. There was a back wall, the same size and with the same metal spikes as the other two, and to her left was the rear of the house. The house itself was wide and 3 stories high, but even though the rear garden was not expansive, it did have one feature that stood out. A single-lane swimming pool, glowing and shimmering blue with the underwater lighting, started right in front of her and continued all the way to the back of the home, 20 meters away. She looked over the house for a while from where she squatted in the landscaping, trying to figure out a way in. But as she eyed the long swimming pool, she saw that it butted up to the home itself, and there was a clear window in the wall there. She could tell by the odd design that it was an indoor-outdoor pool, and that meant there would be some sort of access below the waterline for swimmers. A pair of guards walked across the wraparound balcony on the third floor, strolling lazily together, and she heard notes of idle conversation. The black mat and the rope on the top of the wall behind her were not hidden, but it was dark there, and the color of the mat and cord matched the dark brick wall closely enough. She waited for the guards to make their slow circuit out of view, then ran across the lawn and made it to the wall next to the pool. By staying low, she could avoid being seen from the window next to her, but she glanced through it to see that she had been correct. The interior section of the pool extended into a large dark room with a hot tub and several chaises. A spiral staircase led to a door one level above, and there appeared to be a changing room on the far end of the pool. The only real light in the room came from the glowing indoor pool itself. She crouched at the back door, preparing to pick the lock, but before she'd even begun to do so, a man entered the pool room. She watched him through the glass on the second floor mezzanine. He looked out into the night through the floor-to-ceiling windows. Zoya froze and made herself small. Here in the darkness, she was banking on the man taking her for one of the several planters on the patio next to the lap pool. The man was security. He had a tiny checkmate submachine gun hanging from a strap over his neck. Zoya thought he'd turn away after a moment, but instead, he sat down on a recliner overlooking the pool, kicked his feet up on it, and lay back. Here he began looking through his phone.
"Dermo," she said to herself. "Shit."
After watching the man get comfortable for what appeared to be a leisurely break, she adopted a new plan. She pulled off her pack and the other items taped to her, leaving them there on the patio next to the pool. Then, moving slowly in the darkness, she stripped down to her black sports bra and panties. She slipped her folding knife into her bra, then gently and slowly rolled into the water next to her. Grabbing her lock-picking kit with a telescoping metal shim from the patio next to the pool's edge, she took a deep breath and went underwater. The pool was well lit, so anyone looking her way, either outside or inside, would be able to see her as she worked on the lowered plexiglass door separating the indoor portion of the swimming pool from the outdoor portion. Zoya could see through the plexiglass that it was held in place by a simple lever latch above. She opened the thin metal shim and slid it up. It took some work, but in under a minute she had the latch lifted. She pulled up on the divider, it slid freely now, and she swam under it before gently lowering it and locking it once again. She came to the surface now and began swimming languidly through the water as if she didn't have a care in the world. She made it all the way to the pool stairs before the reclining guard saw the movement. He all but leapt from his resting place, reached a hand inside his jacket, and then stopped himself. Zoya stepped out of the pool, water cascading.